Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On our show today, it turns out adults do it just as much as teens, texting while driving. A new study says older drivers are just as much at fault as younger ones when it comes to using that phone behind the wheel. And property values in Michigan have plunged more than $260 billion since 2008. But new data suggests the decline appears to be slowing down. We'll get details later in the show. But first, tomorrow is Equal Pay Day. It's a national day of recognition about the problem of the wage gap. If you are a woman going to work in Michigan, you will average 73 cents for every dollar made by a man. So says the American Association of University Women. Their just released study finds Michigan ranks seventh among the states and the District of Columbia in the wage gap between men and women. Joining me now to dig into this is the president of the American Association of University Women in Michigan. Welcome to Janet Watkins.
Thank you for having me.
When the report says Michigan ranks seven in the nation, is that list beginning with the best or the worst? Because I guess it could either be not so bad news or really bad news for women workers, depending on what it means to be seventh in the nation.
Unfortunately, it's really bad news. Michigan is down at the bottom with other states like Wyoming, and unfortunately, has a lot to do with a number of factors. Mm-hmm. Michigan is a manufacturing state.
Sure.
And so jobs typically from a historical standpoint have been dominated by men. Mm-hmm. 75% of men dominate the manufacturing jobs in the state. And so that means that fewer women had opportunity to enter into job industries where wages were higher. And with the economy having been what it has been over the past few years, the wage gap that has persisted since 1970, and let me just say this now, that we have made progress. In 1970, it was 59 cent, and we have steadily increased over the years, but it has stalled nationally at 77 cent. And in Michigan, unfortunately, it's down to 73.
And what has it taken to get it moved up from where it was when it was so low? Was that just a lot of campaigning? Was that a lot of re-educating? What did it take?
It has taken a lot of advocacy, public policy work on the part of the American Association of University Women, but along with other like-minded organizations who have pressed for closing the gap. The wage gap exists. It exists no matter what, across all groups. And unfortunately, the impact of the gap is much harder on women. In 1963, 50 years ago, the Equal Pay Act was passed, mm-hmm. signed by President Kennedy, and that went a long way towards prohibiting discrimination based on sex in the workplace with regards to wages. But that is not a marker for celebration.
Okay.
It is a marker that says we still have a lot of work to do.
What did that act actually mandate?
It mandated that employers could no longer base their wages and what they paid their employees based on sex, gender, race, ethnicity.
All right. But here we are.
Here we are.
Talking about the fact that a woman worker in Michigan is going to average 73 cents for every dollar the men get.
Absolutely.
In what industries in Michigan do we find, Janet Watkins, that the wage gap is most prominent?
Well, of course, it's most prominent in manufacturing.
Sure. But manufacturing is certainly having its struggles and losing ground.
Absolutely.
Yes
it is. Now, another thing to note is because Michigan has been a union mm-hmm. state, wages have often been pumped up by the unions because they have to adhere to their own union regulations that men and women have to be paid at the same levels. Mm-hmm. So that has often helped non-union workers with regards to their own wages. But in recent times, with the economy and changes mm-hmm. at the public policy level, we are seeing changes and It's unfortunate when you think of things like right to work and the impact that that may and will, in fact, have.
Give us a sense from where you sit as the president of the American Association of University Women in Michigan. Janet, what effect do you envision this having on the wage gap?
Well, it's only going to make it worse. Right to work is going to hurt women and minorities much, much more because, again, unions typically bring up wages. The impact probably won't be felt immediately, but over time, it will put women further back and into poverty.
Now, backers will say, you're free to join a union and take advantage of what a union can offer.
That's absolutely true in a unionized shop. Mm-hmm. But when you start talking about it, women make up 60% of the pink collar jobs. Mm-hmm. That opportunity is not available to them. So right to work will only continue to push down on their wages.
Well, when we talk about, you know, you'd mentioned health and education. And for example, in education, we do see unions, teachers' unions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And again, when we look at the data in our research, we find that even in some of the areas in which women dominate, uh-huh. men are still being paid more even in those particular fields. So, for example.
Yes, give me an example here.
In the wage gap in the 10 most common occupations for women who are working full time. Uh-huh. And this information is according to the Institute on Women and Public Policy Research. All occupations in these common areas, men's median weekly earnings is $824 versus a woman's weekly earnings of $669. So now you're looking at a gap of 81.2%.
In that occupation was again?
This is all occupations.
Okay, in all
occupations. Now, take a specific occupation, mm-hmm. secretaries and administrative assistants.
Okay.
Men's median weekly earnings, $725. Women, $657.
Why? Why is that? In 2013, why do we see that for the same job that a man will bring home $725, a woman $657?
Well, we've been working hard to determine why that is. Mm-hmm. We have done research to control for all of the areas in which this could cause a wage gap, education, choice of occupation, going into the field that you majored in, and with all of the controls for those specific areas, we still continue to see this persistent gap. Some of it has to do with perception. I believe that HR and employers perceive men as heads of household, and therefore they need more money.
This is not Mad Men in 1962. That's what I'm, it's stunning to me. This is 2013.
I agree with you because, again, women who are heads of household, mm-hmm. And more women every day are heading up households, and not only with households with families, children, but elder care. Many women are taking care of extended families. So again, when you look at the disparity and the tendency to want to pay men more money and not take into consideration that we're all in the same marketplace,
yeah.
It doesn't make any sense.
So, Janet, talk about the effect on minorities of this gender gap.
Well, the pay gap for minorities, Hispanic and African American women, is even larger. African American women make 60 cent on the dollar versus their white male counterpart. And then Hispanic women are making even less at 56 cent on the dollar. And over time, when you look at the numbers, we're talking anywhere from a loss of $200,000 over, let's say, a 40-year period to as much as $2 million if you are an educated, college-educated mm-hmm. woman. So it is really imperative that we find ways to close that gap because it has an impact not only on the people that are affected by it, but of course it also affects everyone else in the community.
We've been talking with the president of the American Association of University Women in Michigan, Janet Watkins, fighting to close that wage gap between men and women. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much, Cynthia, for having me.
The state legislature is back in Lansing, back in session this week after a two-week break. Some lawmakers are calling for action on proposed changes to the state's no-fault auto insurance system. But as Michigan Public Radio's Jake Neer reports, opponents of the changes say legislators need more information before discussions can begin.
Michigan's the only state that offers unlimited medical benefits for life to people injured in auto accidents. The agency that pays those benefits is facing a lawsuit saying it should make public how it comes up with the annual fee to drivers that pays those medical bills. Attorney George Sinus represents the groups that filed the lawsuit.
Why won't they produce this? And I think that the answer is simple. They've got something to hide.
The Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association says most of that information is already available, but the MCCA recently appealed a circuit court ruling that the agency is subject to the Freedom of Information Act. For the Michigan Public Radio Network, I'm Jake Neer in Lansing.
Still to come. Well, the University of Michigan has done it. We all know that by now. The men's basketball team in the final game of the season and ruining March Madness brackets all along the way. We'll get details in 10 minutes. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Texting and driving. When we conjure up an image of someone driving and dashing off text messages, admit it, be honest, most of us think of a teenager. Well, most of us would be wrong, dead wrong. A survey done by AT&T as part of the It Can Wait campaign finds, get ready for this, 98% of adults they surveyed said, yep, we know it's wrong to text and drive, and yep, we do it. The number of teenagers who said the same, 43%. So let's talk about this finding and what it means, just what is going on with drivers in America. Paul Green is a research professor in the Driver Interface Group at the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute. And welcome back to Stateside, Paul.
Thank you.
So to see that 98% of adults are saying, yeah, we know we shouldn't do it, but we do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I see, is up because the survey found that 3 years ago, 6 in 10 adults said they were not doing this, 60%. So what kind of stupid mind games are adults playing with themselves?
I don't know, other than it's just a push for people to do more. And as a consequence, they say, well, driving, I'm not very busy, I'll try and do more. So they'll text while they drive.
You know, it's interesting when you think about the fact, Paul, that we have been able, I think, through a lot of hard work, we've made drinking and driving socially unacceptable. Would you pretty much agree with that?
Yes.
I mean, not that there aren't people who sadly get behind the wheel after drinking, but there seems to be a real awareness of, no, I'll be the designated driver. Mm-hmm. Why has this not happened, do you think, when it comes to texting, cell phones, and driving?
Well, if you look at those cultural changes, mm-hmm. they tend to take a long time. And the example that I can think of is smoking. If you think about it, it was the initial reports of the Public Health Service.
Yes.
I'm blanking on the name of the commission.
Yeah, but that Surgeon General's report,
right.
That was the 1960s,
That's
wasn't
right.
it?
That's right. And it took many years and many, many reports by many Surgeon Generals to mm-hmm. assemble the scientific evidence to make the point. And if you look at the original report, the committee was incredibly talented. They were looking at thousands and thousands of documents that were well vetted. And even with that, it just made a small blip. And it just takes years and years and years to get these kinds of cultural changes related to safety and health. Seatbelts is another one. It's just taken many, many decades for people to change their behavior.
Is it also, could there be something about the fact that most people now almost consider that cell phone an extension of their hand? You know, if I leave it at home, you go back for it. You wouldn't think of venturing forth without your phone. Is it because we look at it differently than we might a bottle of beer?
Yeah, I think you're right, because the smoking, alcohol, etc., is known to have pretty well-established health hazards. It's a little different with the phone because it's an appliance to do work.
The other thing I wondered when we saw the increase with we're at one point just 3 years ago, 6 out of 10 adults said they didn't text and drive, and now you have 98% say, yeah, we do. Do you think that's tied into the rise of smartphones?
It could very well be, because there's just a lot more features.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be that, yeah, years ago people didn't text because texting wasn't supported on their phone.
Or if you had, you know, if you didn't have the smartphone or the QWERTY keyboard, it was tougher to do.
More difficult to do, yes.
So I don't know what the answer is, but is the technology there to be able to do this blocking? I know there is with alcohol, isn't there?
Right. And there are some commercial products that look at your phone, look at the acceleration values, and look at the, therefore can determine the speed at which you're moving and say, well, if you're moving above some speed, there's a good chance you're driving. And therefore, under that circumstance, I will simply not allow text messages to come in, and I'll send a message back to the party that the person is driving. Sometimes that may or may not happen. There's similar features out there for cell phones to block calls as well. Again, they're primarily intended for parents who don't want their kids to talk and drive.
What do you actually do at the Driver Interface Group? What kind of work do you do?
Sure. Well, we do a variety of studies to look at distraction and driver workload. We do them in test cars, and we do them on the road. So let me give you a few examples. So right now we're planning to do a study with Delphi, and the question is, can we do something to warn the driver when they're distracted? So they've developed a technology in which monitors head position. And when drivers are head down in the vehicle, if it's for too long and it provides a little warning, something flashes. Right. Mm. Now, it seems like that's an odd thing to do, because you really want to know where they're looking as opposed to where their head is pointed. But it turns out that pretty much wherever your head is pointed is where you're looking, and it's much easier to measure head position than eye position. So in terms of a sensible technological innovation, this is what we're going to explore. Of course, the question is, does it work? Do people respond to the warning? We'll only know when we get out on the road and have people use this system and see what happens.
Well, it's fascinating to think that work you're doing now could be something that our kids or grandkids just take for granted, the way we do a seatbelt.
That's right. And as an example, that could be very applicable to the texting problem, because the problem is you're looking away from the road. So this system would pick that up.
Well, meantime, I guess I can rely on glaring at drivers if I see them doing it on the road, but I don't think it helps too much. But it is something to just keep in mind, again, with 98% of adults saying they know it's wrong to text and drive, but they do it anyway. Paul Green, a research professor at the Driver Interface Group at the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute. Thanks for talking with us, Paul.
Thank you very much. We'll be right back.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. So, there's a basketball game happening tonight? Well, even the most casual fan knows. The Michigan Wolverines will be scoring off against top-seeded Louisville for the NCAA title tonight. This young Michigan team could make Wolverine history by winning the first title since 1989. Michigan Radio's sports commentator John Eubacon joins us now. Hey, John.
Greetings.
Well, you really, really do know these players. And I'm wondering, what do you think it is about this group of kids and this coach that has put them in this game tonight?
Well, as far as the competitive aspect, the main thing is they all bought into John Beilein's very unique system. He stresses three-point shooting. He stresses ball movement. He's not got the biggest team out there, nor necessarily the fastest, but they work extraordinarily well together. So it's always fun to see a team that buys into a system, plays it very well, and is remarkably selfless as to how they do it. The ball gets passed constantly. They don't care who gets the points. They care about winning. So that alone makes them fun to watch. The second fact is they are having a good time playing. It's the Magic Johnson syndrome. And of course, you recall Magic Johnson, yep, the way he smiled while he played. These guys are having a good time and enjoying each other's company.
Correct me if I'm wrong, John, but these really do seem like the kids next door.
Very much so. Now, they're bigger than the kids next to your house, probably.
That's true.
but you got guys like Mitch McGarry. This guy, when he's about 10 or 12, he got a unicycle to run his paper route and actually did his paper route on his unicycle. That's not your average guy.
No.
To say the least, Nick Stauskas is from Canada. And despite that fact, he does not care at all about hockey and seems to know nothing about it, which is kind of cool in a way. Whenever he plays well, which is quite often, they've got a maize and blue Canada national flag, actually, in the stands, which you'll probably see this weekend, tonight, that is.
Yeah.
So it's kind of neat. And his parents are from Lithuania, so he comes by, and honestly, they offered he and his brother the choice to either have a backyard pool, a tennis court, or hoops. And these guys picked hoops, so he's a hardcore basketball guy. Perhaps, without question, the biggest star of the team is Trey Burke.
Sure.
He's won almost every National Player of the Year honor, so he's cleaned up, to say the least. His dad, and by the way, all these families are deeply involved in their kids' lives, which is one thing that I know Beilein really appreciates, which certainly makes him easier to coach, too, I think, in many ways. They have very strong family backgrounds. And his dad made Trey Burke eat and brush his teeth left-handed as a kid to make sure he was ambidextrous, which may sound a little crazy, but apparently it worked.
Dad with his eye on the long-term prize.
Yeah, exactly. Not about strength, but about ball handling.
Yeah.
And he was right. The guy is ambidextrous, and that part paid off. You've also got three sons of NBA celebrities. You've got Tim Hardaway Jr., Glenn Robinson III, and John Horford. And all three of their dads were NBA stars, which is actually a very cool thing also because John Beilein knows that those players, for all the corruption in college basketball, those players can't be bought off. $30,000 is pretty small when your dad has got $30 million. So being bought off was not part of their dad's agenda. What their dads wanted in all three cases was a very stable program where the kids would go to school and not be exploited. So in that sense, Beilein was very savvy going against for these NBA stars' kids who have fit in very, very well in the program.
And give us some insights, personal insights, about Coach Beilein. When I think of that story, that really compelling story of this veteran coach who's 60 and he's matched with this astonishingly young team, why has that worked so well?
John is a great teacher, and he's spoken before my class at Michigan. And what strikes me about it when he does that, yes, we talk about basketball, yes, we talk about Michigan hoops and whatnot. He really spent his time talking about the 150 students in my class, which is not what the average celebrity does. And he's got an innate ability to connect with them almost immediately and put himself in their shoes and say, look, when I was, 20, 21, here's what I was thinking, here's what I wanted to do, and explains how he went from working in sanitation in upstate New York. He's actually in a manhole, and when his uncle comes by and says, hey, a job opened up at a junior high school down the street, are you interested? At that point, John is ankle deep in you-know-what. He looks around his surroundings, and then he looks up at his uncle through the hole in the street and says, yeah, that sounds pretty good to me.
Wow.
He didn't debate it too much. But this is the guy who's earned his keep, paid all his dues, and then some. Always loved college basketball and always sacrificed for it. So see a guy like that really have his path pay off. And we're talking Canisius, Lemoyne, Erie Community College, Richmond, then finally West Virginia, then finally Michigan. This guy has paid a lot of dues, and he's really taken it in stride. He said before last week that if he never got to a Final Four, he would still be okay. Most coaches don't think that. They tend to be crazy.
So he looks at the process, I think, of working with the kids.
Exactly. He engages them. He's a natural teacher, and with his complicated system, that's essential. He's not just recruiting talent and throwing them on the court, which is what a lot of big-time coaches sadly do. He is really engaged with these kids, really teaching them. He does not put up with much. In my class, I don't put up with much, no late papers, and he always makes sure that his players who want to get in got a shot to get in because he wants them to have a no-nonsense education. Other coaches might avoid that scenario. He strives for it, which says a lot right there. I will say this, though. Most Michigan coaches want exactly that for their student-athletes.
Now, this is likely the final game wearing maize and blue for some of these players. So which kids do you expect to head to the NBA after the game tonight, John?
I would be floored beyond floored if Trey Burke does not go to the NBA after this. He's going to be a high first-rounder. He is the best player in the nation. So he is 99.9% sure to be gone. There are others who are candidates. Mitch McGarry, I mentioned, the big kid. He's a freshman. He has said that he plans on coming back. So I'm not sure who else might be leaving. My guess is one or two might also join Trey Burke. But the rest could come back next year. And if they do, they'll have another great team with, granted, the best player gone. But they'll still be very competitive. But outside of Trey, I couldn't say for sure. But Trey is gone.
Well, Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon will be joining us on the show tomorrow to talk about the outcome of tonight's game. John, thanks so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
As the Michigan Wolverines go after their first NCAA championship since 1989, fan excitement is at a fever pitch, which is translating into a rush to get the maize and blue wearables and goodies that marks you as a Wolverine fan, and that in turn is adding up to healthy sales for stores that stock Wolverine merchandise. Stores like Ulrich's Bookstore, right in the heart of the U of M campus. Store manager Todd Goetz joins us now. Hi, Todd.
How are you doing today?
Good. How are you doing? How much busier
Great.
Are you because of us, this whole big championship run?
Things are going extremely well, especially towards the end of last week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, with all the students going down to Atlanta. Everybody stopped in to get some good Michigan gear to take down there with them.
So who do you see coming in? Clearly students. Who else is coming?
All the townspeople, people from all over the state, really. Out of state, people are coming into town for orientation groups, those kind of things. Everybody's stopping by to get some Michigan product.
Now, I'm curious, how does it work? We see this when there's a big, I've seen this with the Stanley Cup, when the final game is played. It's game seven. And suddenly everybody's skating around with hats and shirts that say Stanley Cup champs. So is there an amount of merchandise that's ready to go if they win tonight that says champions?
The printers start printing immediately after the game is over. They have some merchandise that they have for either team if they win, just so they can start advertising the gear.
Okay.
But immediately after that, people start printing product overnight. And we'll be down picking up merchandise at 6, 7 o'clock in the morning on Tuesday morning if we win.
So literally shirts or baseball caps or whatever it is, people
yeah,
are going to be
usually
working.
Shirts and baseball caps are the first thing.
What's the mood in the store right now, especially with your staff?
Everybody's really excited. The staff's excited. We're having a good time. It's a great time in Ann Arbor.
Todd Goetz manages the Ulrich's Bookstore in Ann Arbor, right at the heart of the U of M campus. Todd, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
By the way, a congressman from Kentucky and his counterpart here in Michigan have wagered bourbon, beer, fried chicken, and a deli lunch on the winner of tonight's game. U.S. Representative John Yarmuth, who's a Democrat from Kentucky, put up a bottle of Woodford Reserve bourbon and a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken against a wager by our own John Dingell. He's wagering Arbor Brewing Company beer and a lunch from Zingerman's Deli, both restaurants, of course, in Ann Arbor. And here at Stateside, we always love to hear from you. What stories do you want to hear more about? What issues are on your mind? Let us know. Find us on Facebook. You can search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And of course, you can always find us at the website, michiganradio.org, and just click on the link that says Stateside. Well, it might not sound like it on today's Stateside, but yes, we are right in the midst of Michigan Radio's spring membership drive. So I want to take this moment to talk about your listening to Michigan Radio. Maybe it's the little things you value. Scott Simon's laugh during your Saturday mornings, or your laughs during Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Or maybe it's the fact our reporters always go the extra mile to get you the story. Well, we can bring you the little things and the big things like in-depth news that you rely on because of the way we're funded. Listener support, your support. That's what makes all the difference. And that's why it's so important for you to do your part to show your support for Michigan Radio and do it right now. Call 888-258-9866 or you can go online, michiganradio.org. Again, the number to call, 888-258-9866. Still to come, on this Holocaust Remembrance Day, we bring you the story of an Ann Arbor woman who survived not one, but three Nazi death camps.
She said, you have to look all around you and be very observant. And in the beginning, she said, I didn't know if I wanted to survive the war, but this is just human instinct.
The story of Miriam Garville comes up in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Any property owner or any city or township elected official knows this fact all too well. When it came to the housing bubble that popped 5 years ago, Michigan got, well, it got clobbered. Since 2008, property values in Michigan have plunged by more than $260 billion. But a new analysis by Bridge Magazine finds while the decline may have continued last year, it does appear to be, thankfully, slowing down. Ted Roloffs is a contributing writer for Bridge Magazine. His series of reports, The Big Flush 2, Not as Flushed, are being published this week in Bridge. And Ted joins us now from Grand Rapids. Hi, Ted.
Good to be here.
So there is a sense that perhaps the worst is over and that proverbial light at the end of the tunnel might be on the horizon?
Yeah, and I don't think if you talk to economists who've analyzed this, and nobody's got a perfect crystal ball. We don't know for certain what next year is going to be like. We don't know for certain what the year after that is going to be like. I think the general sense is that any recovery that we're going to experience in Michigan is not going to be a spectacular rebound. It's going to be slow, gradual, and the point that we're looking at in many different ways in this series is that because of the nature of Proposal A, which limits the increase in property taxable value to 5% or the rate of inflation, whichever is less, the local governments will only very slowly recoup the steep drop they experienced as a result of this plunge in property values. So they can go down 10%, 15% in the course of a year or two, but you're not going to get it back that quickly because of Proposal A.
And that was the one we voters passed in 1994.
That's correct.
Ted, last year Michigan was, eighth in the nation in the rate of foreclosures. Where do you expect that number to be in years to come?
It seems like we're going to be losing that title, hopefully. we're one of the leading states in the country in terms of foreclosure rates. It seems like that's been the trend. And, again, it's hard to have a crystal ball, but ideally that would be where we're headed. I mean, there are certainly many of the real estate markets around Michigan are reporting some pretty healthy numbers in terms of the prices of homes sold. They're up Ann Arbor, they're up in the Grand Rapids area, they're up in the greater Traverse City area. It's a limited number of homes. One of the things I discovered in looking through this is that there's actually fewer homes on the market than to satisfy demand, because so many people have homes where they're underwater, where they owe more than the home is worth. So those, even though those people might want to sell their homes, they're not able to afford to do so. So that's actually been driving up the price of homes, because in some markets there's not enough supply to meet the demand for homes. And in some of these markets, I've found that homes in a marketable home in nice shape and places like in the Ann Arbor area, they're gone sometimes in a matter of days.
But it's just that catch-22. If you are underwater and you can't sell at the price you need to sell, you might want to sell, but your hands are tied.
And so maybe that gradually works itself out as values start to climb up. And then maybe at some point, maybe a year from now, maybe 2 years from now, maybe you're no longer underwater. When you fall as precipitously as we did in terms of the housing market here, you're not going to get out of that overnight.
So have faith.
I guess.
And you have to learn to be patient, as we've learned this in Michigan, as this slow recovery happens after the big burst.
So, well, I think we all got a little, inebriated on the idea that housing values only go one direction, and that wasn't unique to, obviously, to Michigan.
No.
That happened around the country, and we paid a severe price for that.
Ted Roloff has a series being published this week in Bridge Magazine, The Big Flush 2, Not As Flushed. And we've been talking to Ted from Grand Rapids. Ted, thanks so much.
I was glad to do it.
Never again, heeding the warning signs. That's the theme of the National Days of Remembrance this week long. Congress created the Days of Remembrance as our nation's annual commemoration of the Holocaust and the 6 million Jews who died in the Nazi Holocaust, along with millions of others. It's linked with the Holocaust Remembrance Day that was created 60 years ago by Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion. Today is Holocaust Remembrance Day, and that turns our thoughts to the ever-shrinking ranks of the survivors, the men and the women who suffered through the years of Nazi domination, who survived the prison camps, or who managed to hide from the Nazis through the war. Hearing their firsthand stories, preserving their stories, and handing them down is one way to fight back against genocide. One such survivor is 91-year-old Miriam Garville of Ann Arbor. She wanted her story preserved. And thanks to my next guest, her story of survival through not one but three Nazi concentration camps has been recorded and put into a book called I Have to Survive, Miriam's Story. Ruth Campbell based her book on oral history recordings that she did with Miriam. And Ruth Campbell is kind enough to join us now from Japan. Welcome to Stateside, Ruth.
Oh, thank you.
So you first encountered Miriam Garville how?
Well, I was a social worker at the University of Michigan Geriatric Center. And Miriam came to talk to me. Miriam and her husband both came to talk to me because her son had a serious health condition,
and she needed some advice. And then her son unfortunately died in his 40s. And so after his death, we spent many times talking, and eventually she started talking about her experiences during the Holocaust.
So how did that click in for you to decide to record her oral history of her Holocaust survival story and then turning it into an actual book?
Well, you know, often with people, one death with an older person, one death triggers memories of earlier traumatic experiences, earlier deaths. And it seemed that it might be therapeutic, it might be helpful for Miriam to go over what had happened to her during the war. And so I asked her if she wanted to record her story, and she said yes, she really wanted it to be a book. She wanted people to hear and know what she went through so that other people would understand what happened and maybe prevent anything like that ever happening again.
So give us an idea of Miriam's life as a girl in Lodz, Poland, before the Nazi occupation.
Well, that was one of my favorite parts of the book. She had a very nice childhood. She had lived in a privileged family. Her mother ran a very nice apartment building, was a manager there, and she was very proud of her mother for being a working woman when many mothers weren't at that time. Her father had a textile factory, and Lodz was a rather prosperous place, and there was a large Jewish community there. She went ice skating. She went out to summer camps. She had a very nice childhood. She loved movies. She went out to the movies all the time and enjoyed her life, had a lot of friends.
And she was one of two children, right? She had a sister?
Yes, she had an older sister.
So when the Germans marched into Poland and the family's life was torn apart, how old was Miriam at the time?
Miriam was 18 when she lost everybody. She and her family first left Lodz. They had to leave and went to another small town in Poland. But soon the Nazis came, and her father was taken to a work camp. And he was later killed. And her mother and sister and Miriam were on a train going to a crematorium. They didn't know it at the time. They thought they were going to a work camp, too.
Yeah.
But the train was packed and awful, and Miriam just felt she couldn't take it. And she said she was going to jump. And her mother said, don't. And she did. She thought she was going to die. But she was saved by people who found her. She went into hiding, and then eventually she went into three concentration camps. And she was the only one in her family to survive. No, it just struck me, you know, thinking of my children, my grandchildren. My granddaughter was 18 at the time. And I thought, how can an 18-year-old, you know, go through that and just be completely alone all of a sudden after having such a protected and happy childhood?
Her first camp experience was the Płaszów camp, the one that was made famous by the story in the movie Schindler's List, and that's where Camp Commander Amon Göth would amuse himself by taking target practice at prisoners and riding around the camp on his horse, just as we saw in Spielberg's film.
Right.
How did Miriam, first of all, survive Płaszów?
Well, I think she just survived it by doing what she did in all those places. She said you had to be quick, you had to really keep an open eye, you had really to understand what was going on and get away. She said, if I didn't know what was happening, if I didn't see all over what you're supposed to do in the moment to be able to survive, she said, you have to look all around you and be very observant. And in the beginning, she said, I didn't know if I wanted to survive the war, but this is just human instinct. You do that, you run. So I think she just, you know, wanted to survive and was determined to survive.
I'm speaking with Ruth Campbell, who sat down with Holocaust survivor Miriam Garville of Ann Arbor. She's 91 years old, and she wanted her story preserved. And thanks to Ruth Campbell's efforts, taking an oral history and then taking that history and turning it into a book called I Have to Survive, Miriam's Story. So from Płaszów, she then was transported to Auschwitz. Talk about that experience.
Well, I think Auschwitz, she said, was as bad or worse worse than Krakow, Plaschow, and Auschwitz. Typically, they'd had the Appelplatz. You'd be at the Appelplatz, which was the roll call, and they'd play this beautiful music, opera music, American music. She said beautiful music, and they would be shooting people, and you never knew, you know, who would. You'd stand there and never knew if you would be shot. And meanwhile, you're listening to this beautiful music. But I think what the other thing that impressed me in Auschwitz was how the people in the camps worked together. And she was in the laundry room, and she managed to wash the shirts of some of the prisoners, male prisoners who went out with the soldiers to work during the day. And then in return, they would smuggle back bread for her so that they would have something to eat. And they all worked together to do these things in order to get to get enough food to live, because at Auschwitz they got a plate of mustard. She called it the mustard camp because they had this slogan over the door that work makes you free, but she called it mustard makes you free, the mustard camp, because they give you a plate of mustard, and that's all you had, and some watery soup. So there was never enough to eat.
And somehow she did escape the line that would send people to the gas showers and then onto the crematorium. And she not survived Auschwitz, but then on to the third camp, Bergen-Belsen. And she said that was the worst of all?
She said that was absolutely the worst because, well, first of all, they had the long march from Auschwitz to Bergen-Belsen, which many people didn't survive. And at Bergen-Belsen, there was nothing to eat. And she said it was a death camp. It was just, she had got typhoid. She and other people just lay under the bunks. It was just impossible there. And she thought that she was going to die then. But British soldiers came in April 15th, 1945, and liberated them. But she could hardly move, and she was transported to Sweden to recuperate.
In fact, she speaks very fondly of her time in Stockholm as she began to recuperate from her experience. And she eventually came to America. How did she wind up in Ann Arbor?
Well, she was living in Paris. She married her husband in Paris, and they lived there. And then they came to New York and lived in New York for many years. But her son, George, was working for General Motors. And so she and her husband decided to move to Ann Arbor to be closer to him.
So I'm interested, as you sat with Miriam Garville and you heard her story and relived these memories with her, Ruth Campbell, what hit you the hardest, particularly as she talked about her life in the camps?
I just couldn't imagine. You know, I'd heard, of course, everyone knows these stories, but hearing it from one person, hearing Miriam talk about being a young girl and what happened and being in the camps and being, you know, having to survive by your wits and never knowing. She said she was supposed to be burned one day, and then they said, oh, we need young women, so come with us. And she said that's what happened. You know, they thought they were going to die, and then something would happen, and she somehow survived. It just struck me the cruelty of the whole thing and how it was all planned. It seemed so organized somehow, and that made it even worse. You know, I really felt so much admiration for her, and I felt she was very brave, and she was very lucky to have gone through all that and survived.
And in fact, survived and went on to have, you know, a life as a wife and a mother.
Yes.
And so survived and surpassed. I mean, she conquered it.
Yes, she did. And I think it showed her resilience and her toughness and the fact that she really kept saying to herself, I have to survive, I have to survive. She had heard her father say this in the beginning of this experience, and she just kept repeating what her father said, I have to survive, I have to survive, and she did.
Ruth, what lessons would you like to share with all of us that you learned from working with Miriam? What would you like us to learn from your experience?
I would love people to listen to the stories of older people. I mean, Miriam's was an extreme situation, and in that case, I felt that the more documentation we have, as you said, this generation is dying, the generation who experienced that, or they're older now, they'll be dying. We need to have these eyewitness reports. We need to have this so that people can read it and know that this should never happen again. But for people who had maybe less extreme kinds of experiences than that, I think all older people had lives that are worth listening to, and I would really encourage people to record stories of older people they know, of their family members, of friends. For me, it's always been just such an amazing experience to be invited to listen to people's lives, and I think I hope more people would do that. I think it's not only a wonderful thing for the person talking about their lives, but to us, the people who listen, it's just very important.
Ruth Campbell worked with Holocaust survivor Miriam Garville of Ann Arbor on her memoirs. The book's entitled I Have to Survive, Miriam's Story, and it's available on Amazon.com. And Ruth Campbell spoke to us today from Japan. Thank you so much, Ruth.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
And we should note, America's first freestanding Holocaust Memorial Center is here in Michigan. It's in Farmington Hills in Oakland County. Holocaust survivors meet and speak with visitors. There are powerful exhibits and many, many recorded histories. Visitors and school groups are more than welcome, and you can find out more at holocaustcenter.org. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Our contributors are Ellie Billings, Austin Davis, Maya Friedman, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, and April Van Buren. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow at 3:00.